Today's guest, Myrna Murray, is the Executive Director of Disability Rights Rhode Island. She has more than 25 years of experience working in public policy and advocacy in the private sector, state government, and on Capitol Hill. Prior to joining Disability Rights Rhode Island, she served as Commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Developmental Disability Services and a member of Governor Dan Malloy's cabinet. In that position, she oversaw state services for children and adults with disabilities throughout Connecticut. Prior to that, she was president and CEO of the Connecticut Community Providers Association, advocating and lobbying for disabilities and behavior health nonprofit providers at the state level. So as you can see, Myrna has an incredible depth of knowledge and experience, and I'm really excited to bring her on to talk to you, to talk to me about the disability rights, specifically Disability Rights Rhode Island, but they're part of something bigger. They're part of a national network of protection and advocacy agencies that were created by Congress, and they exist in every state and territory. Their focus is to help secure and advance the rights of people with disabilities, and there's a total of 57 of these in the United States, territories, and District of Columbia. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I know I'm gonna learn something, and I really look forward to hearing your feedback on what you liked and didn't like after we're done. Let's dive in. Welcome, everyone. Today, we're going to talk about Disability Rights Rhode Island. And from there, we're going to have a little bit of a larger discussion about what protection advocacy agencies do. There's 57 of these agencies in every state and territory. So there's quite a bit. They're federally mandated and funded. And I have Myrna Murray with me to talk. She's the executive director of Disability Rights Rhode Island to talk to me about it. Myrna, thank you for joining me. And I'm really looking forward to this.
Thank you, Eric. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we were talking ahead of time about all the different things, and I'm struggling a little bit to figure out where to even start because you guys do so much. Could we start, if you're open to it, how did you get involved with the disability space? You know, very often, like myself and many of the other guests I've had, it's because they have a personal connection. Is that true with you? Do you mind sharing if that's true? Is that how you got connected to the disability space?
Yes, absolutely. It is true. My son has a disability, and I think I will call it a migration to the disability space took place over a number of years, because I was always working in policy, public policy, lobbying, et cetera, for vulnerable populations, including people with disabilities. And then little by little, I guess starting maybe 6, 7, 8 years ago, I started working exclusively on behalf of people with disabilities. Yeah. And with, I should say. I always want to emphasize it's with people with disabilities, not speaking for them, speaking with them. Right. So
that's a really good point. And it's by the numbers and the studies I've read, they're the largest minority population. And it's a population that any of us could become a member of, right? I mean,
absolutely. Any of us could at any moment, if we already don't and maybe aren't completely aware of it, have a disability of one sort or another.
So. Or like we were talking ahead of time, we have a disability, we don't acknowledge it or we don't identify as having it. Like I was sharing with you, you know, even though I'm according to the VA, I'm 90% disabled, I don't identify as being disabled. And some of it's because I don't feel limited. But the other part of it is, if I'm being completely transparent, it's I feel like there's a lot of negative connotations tied to that word disability. As much as I wish that wasn't the world we lived in, it is. And that's why I'm excited to have you, though, because Disability Rights Rhode Island is all about making that, you know, that negative connotation that people may have. And then because they have that connotation, they may be withholding services or the ability, maybe they're not hiring, they're not observing the right, I'm not saying it right, but they're not doing what they should by people who happen to have a disability. They're not right. Seeing the person as a person. They're letting fear or exactly. Some other, whatever it is, get in the way. So do you mind, I guess that's a good segue into what is the mission of disability rights? I mean, what was the mandate for?
So the mandate is for protecting and advocating for the civil rights of people with civil and legal rights of people with disabilities and full inclusion in our society at every level. But I think what you're talking about is part and parcel of that. The stigma, the sort of less than-ness of attitudes towards people with disabilities. You know, I've as a parent and as a person who struggles with issues myself and is surrounded, frankly, on a daily basis, I don't see any less than in the people that I work with and talk with and advocate on behalf of at times. I don't see that. I see people who are just people who have struggles like all of us. Maybe they're different. They have challenges like all of us. Maybe they're different. They need some assistance. And I, you know, not to go too high level on this conversation, but sometimes I think about, like, you know, what is the best way? Like, yes, we're the PNAs, there's 57 of us. We have a federal mandate to go out there and really fight for inclusion of people with disabilities, fight against abuse and neglect and a bias and discrimination. Sometimes I do wonder, though, I must say, like, there's certain areas where you I don't know what the old saying is, but it's like you want to change something. Sometimes rather than fight against what's bad about a particular thing, you should show people that there's a better way. Show them how to do that better way. And sometimes I think about that a lot in terms of disabilities, because, you know, we're fighting for, quote unquote, not always fighting. Sometimes we're persuading, sometimes we're advocating for, sometimes we're lobbying. So we have a lot of different tools that we use, but we're showing people basically full circle to what you were talking about. Inclusion is what we all should experience. Inclusion is good for all of us. It's not just good for people with disabilities. As you know, I'm sure, in the work that you do, I'm sure you hear from employers all the time who say, like you were just saying, maybe they're afraid to hire somebody with a disability because they don't know what it's going to be like. They don't know if they can communicate with them. They're afraid that maybe there'll be behaviors that they don't understand, all these different kinds of fears that people have. We hear over and over, and the research shows this, that employers who hire people with disabilities, they have a better workplace. They routinely talk about their employees with disabilities as being like the best employees that they have, and that they contribute to the workspace and the environment in ways that nobody could ever have imagined. So anyway, that's a very long answer to what you asked me. Whenever I talk with you, we always go into all different kinds of things, which are very interesting, which I appreciate. But yeah, there's just so much here to talk about.
Yeah. And
but we're about civil rights and inclusion.
Really, civil rights means what? What are civil rights? I mean, I think people are familiar with Civil Rights Act, but let's really get down to the basics. What is a civil right?
Well, I mean, people have the right to live their lives free of discrimination. So they should be able to be fully employed in an integrated job. They should not be discriminated against in housing. We have many people who are struggling with housing issues now during COVID and post-COVID. They are entitled to, you know, young people are entitled to effective transition services as they're coming out of high school, you know, and embarking upon their adult lives. People are entitled to be free of abuse and neglect if they need treatment in the community or in a facility setting. They're entitled to vote. there are so many different kinds of, I mean, I guess when we talk about rights, there are certain rights that are conferred by statute in our country, you know, the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act, not to get too technical on people. And then there's other rights that we work on behalf of in connection with legislation that's been passed, the Voting Rights Act, what we've done with voting, employment discrimination, housing discrimination, all of those things. It's not necessarily different for people with disabilities, but their experience in the community can be very different because of their disability.
Well, and housing's interesting to me because housing discrimination, for me, it's tough, right? Because a lot of houses are not built to be accessible. And there's no law requiring a certain number of houses in any community be, in air quotes, accessible.
Right.
But because there's no law, nobody's violating that law. So, you know, when you're saying housing discrimination, it's more of they're not getting a house because of how they look or something else, right? I mean, it can happen.
It's not that
they can't afford a house.
Like, we had a case recently of a family, I think, I can't remember, was a single mom or parents, but they had a child with autism who liked to jump on the floor and they were in an apartment building. And so the tenant below them was complaining about the noise. That's understandable, right? Mm-hmm. The child was making a lot of noise. And they came to us because the landlord's response to that was to try to evict them.
That's where they jumped to, instead of trying to find a first floor unit or something like that. I mean, my first thought would, okay, can we find them a first floor unit?
Right, right. There wasn't a first floor unit available. One of our attorneys suggested maybe some soundproofing for the floor. Yep. As we were in the process of negotiating that, a first floor unit did become available. So it did have a very good, you know, resolution. But that's just one example because, you know, the other piece of this, as you know, is parents when they have kids with disabilities, especially developmental disabilities that require a lot of therapies and a lot of ongoing work to make sure that your child is getting everything that they need, parents are stressed to the max. So, and a lot of people, their incomes are stressed to the max. It's expensive, right? Yep. And so this mom was like really stressed. And it was a very satisfying case for us to be able to help her, because without our assistance, I'm not tooting our horn. I'm just saying it's the value of the P&A system. I think without our assistance, number one, she, you know, might have to pay for legal assistance. And number two, I don't know if they would have had the kind of resolution that we got, you know? So landlords, you know, they just, I mean, people don't want to necessarily get involved in the particulars. Yeah. You know, and sometimes the solutions are a lot easier than you think, really.
No, I agree. And the same thing can be said about when you're making accommodations in a workplace, right? Very often, I think employers jump to, oh my gosh, it's going to be, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And really, it can probably be done for a couple $100, you know, or something. It doesn't have to be super dramatic, you know. But the flip side of that is I see too many voc rehab counselors, other professionals, when they're talking to employers, leading with, oh, these are the accommodations we're going to make. And it drives me nuts. It's like, you haven't even said how this person can solve the employer's problem, right? So I'm a small business. If you're coming to me and saying, this is what it's going to cost you, yeah, no, right. I don't need it that bad.
Exactly. Would you go to, would you interview for a job and say, here's what I need?
No.
Here's what I need before you give me the job that I would like to have. I want to be close to the coffee machine. I want to paint the walls of my office blue, by the way. And I want my whiteboard exactly 6 feet by 5 feet, because otherwise I can't see. No, we don't do that. We just don't do that. And there's lots of things that we want as neurotypical people. And, you know, what you're talking about, I call that deficit centric. You know, we focus on people's deficits instead of focusing on the gifts that they have and the skills and the, you know, all the different things that they bring to an environment. Like sometimes the accommodation is as simple as being open-minded, you know, yes, and compassionate. Sometimes they're really isn't a lot that is required in the way of accommodation for a person with a disability in the job environment.
Well, what if we could even just get rid of accommodation, you know, use the word accommodation, but get rid of for a person with disability. Just say, you know, all of our employees probably need some type of accommodation, period. And just stop. You don't need to add disability. I had a guest, Rebecca Beam. She runs Zavicon. She was one of my earlier guests, but she was saying how when she was a single mom, her accommodation was she had to leave early for her kids.
Yes.
Well, that's not because she had a disability. And, you know, the employer was willing to do it because they knew how much they were getting out of her.
Right.
So I think if we stop saying, and maybe this is something that can help, is instead of just stop saying this person needs an accommodation because, and it, you know, now you add because of a disability. Well, mm-hmm. Now it almost taints it, right? It almost puts this other aura. Instead of saying, look, there's going to be people you have that work for you that want the morning shift because they have to be home for their kids because they're a single parent. Or there's going to be people that, you know, want to work remotely because they're, you know, for whatever reason, you know, why do we have to throw in there because of the disability? Unless it's because we're worried about, you know, complying with ADA or whatever. But I just feel like we're making it worse by adding, and maybe this is my own baggage, but I mean, it feels like it makes it worse by adding because of a disability. Does that make mm-hmm. sense?
Oh yeah. I mean, I think there's two parts to what you're saying. You know, one is the aura that we're creating around the person with the disability. You're leading with deficits, and that's not ever a good plan. But two, there are legal requirements that come into it. So, right. So, you know, if someone has lost their job because they haven't received an accommodation, you know, then that's when accommodations come into it. We go back to an employer if we take that case and we say, look, you know, you're legally required to accommodate this person because of their disability, right? But if you're talking about just the more philosophical idea of what is the workspace that we're trying to create, you know, like I think COVID has done a lot for expanding our thinking around that. Not that we saw that coming or expected that that would be one of the results, but you know, my office, for example, is hybrid. People make their own schedules. I mean, I sign off on their schedule, but everybody makes their own schedule. And I work remotely for large parts of my weeks. And we have found that to be very, very successful. Now, if somebody had come to me before COVID and said, you know what, I just want to work from home, probably I would not have agreed. You know, I might be a little more open-minded than a lot of people, because you raise an excellent point about single moms, because I was accommodated, you know, since probably like the late 90s by every employer that I had. And I would just raise it very transparently and say, I must leave, you know, I must leave by 4 o'clock. I can't say that my coworkers were crazy about me having that accommodation. Certain coworkers at various times, but I had a very specific one. I was, you know, adamant about having it. I needed it. I needed it to be home for my kids, and in particular, my son. So yeah, I mean, like, I guess in a sense, when you have a family member with a disability, you think differently about that whole notion of accommodations. And maybe that is a broader discussion for people in general. Like, what do you need to be at your optimum? That's really what we're talking about.
I like that. What do you need to be at your optimum? I think if employers said that during interviews, what do you need to be at your optimum? I don't think there's, and you're the attorney, right? I mean, you can tell me if there's any legal minefields there, but I feel like that's a safe thing to ask.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a human thing to ask too. It's always nice to remember that we're all humans together, connected. We all have good days and bad days. It is asking a lot, I know.
Well,
we can hope.
Yeah, I mean, it leads to another thing, another huge issue I have with employers, and the fact that this, actually, I can't take credit for this, but it was brought up to me by a friend of mine. You know, he said if people would just look at what their job postings are written, and just if they really took a minute and said, do we really need all of these things, all these requirements? Because that is what eliminates a lot of people with disabilities from applying. You know, if you are a programmer, do you really need to be customer? Do you really need the same skills as a customer facing help desk?
Mm-hmm.
Probably not. So why does the job description have the same requirements? You know,
true.
But that's, you know, I'm getting into a whole nother, I warned you about rabbit holes.
That's okay. I have my own.
So you're the two powers that Disability Rights Rhode Island has that I wrote down are, number one, to investigate reports of abuse and neglect of people with disabilities. And number two, pursue appropriate legal remedies on behalf of persons with disabilities, including enforcement of their civil rights. And that's where it goes back to that example you had given earlier about the apartment, where you would actually, lawyers get involved, and if need be, they'll go as far as going to court.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we take individual cases. So in terms of how we work legally, I mean, when we do more than just legal, but legal is our primary focus. We're talking about people's legal rights. We take individual cases, but we're also very conscious of bringing what we would call more systemic legal actions, like class actions or other legal actions on behalf of multiple people that we would hope to then be successful in getting a more systemic remedy. Like an example of that, like you were mentioning earlier on, is our class action lawsuit for prisoners with mental health disabilities, that we have going on in the state of Rhode Island. And that came about after a number of years of people reporting to us that people with mental illness in our adult prison system were being subjected to solitary confinement and for behaviors relating to their mental illness. Now that you know, can take us into a whole other conversation.
Yeah, I have whole issues with solitary confinement. I have whole issues with that to begin with. But
yeah, and what is causing the behaviors that we're saying are attributable to mental, is it really their mental illness? Is it the environment that they're in? Is it the treatment that they're receiving on a daily basis? I mean, there's so many other issues that go along with that. But that's the primary issue at the heart of our class action lawsuit. So that's an example of systemic action. You know, there's other, you're familiar, of course, with what we call Olmstead Supreme Court case. Just so happens the original plaintiff in Olmstead, I think, just passed away this week, Lois Curtis. But Olmstead is the right, Olmstead is a Supreme Court case from 1999 that established the right of people with disabilities to live in the community, live in the most integrated or the least restrictive environment. And there were two women at the heart of that case that originated in Georgia, and they were in an institution and they wanted to live in the community, and they were ultimately successful in doing that. But there's many, many Olmstead cases going on around the country, and we're doing some work in Rhode Island on that issue as well.
Wow. And you know, that led to, if I remember correctly, that's part of what led to these HCBS waivers, home and community-based services waivers.
Yes.
The Katie Beckett, where, you know, Katie Beckett was a whole different case. She was another woman who, you know, they wanted to, again, get treated outside of hospitals. But yeah, it's, and what worries, not asking for your opinion, I'm just going to, you know, this is just a little sidebar, but I'm not very comfortable with the current state of the Supreme Court with how they're going to judge in any future disability cases. There's a case right now, I don't know if it's been, I haven't seen anything that's been ruled on yet about being able to sue states for Medicaid and Medicare.
Yes.
You know, that worries
me.
That's a
really important case.
Yeah, I'm really worried to see where this, how it falls out. Mm-hmm. Because if they take away that protection, I don't have a warm fuzzy that states are going to do the right thing.
Yeah, we've signed on to an amicus brief in that case. We're following that very closely and are very concerned about it as well. You know, the only thing I can say, I would say about the Supreme Court being involved, as it always has been, involved in very important cases that will affect the rights of people with disabilities, is if there's any issue that should be above partisan politics, it is disabilities, right? And I use that as what I consider to be like just a core truth when I'm talking to people about disabilities. And, you know, if we're at our General Assembly in Rhode Island, or we're talking to other policymakers, really there's no politics. Just like you said, we're all, you know, one breath away or one day away from having a disability ourselves. So it's a human issue.
Yeah.
Politics.
But where I see
politics.
Where I see politics getting involved is when you start talking about the social safety nets, like
the funding,
access to SSI and SSDI, Social Security and Medicaid, Medicare. And
absolutely.
Before I have a question related to that, but do you mind explaining what an amicus brief is for anybody that's listening that doesn't know?
Oh, it's friend of the court. In other words, we sign on to a particular side of a case that with which we agree, and we want to lend our support. So, and I probably shouldn't talk a lot about that particular case in terms of what we're arguing, but yeah, we're, you know, any group can do that with a significant case before the Supreme Court, and frequently do.
Yeah.
So that is something that is front and center right now, and we'll be looking to see what happens with that and what, hopefully they'll decide it the right way.
Yeah, knock on wood. And I liken it in my mind to having the opportunity to make comments on Medicaid recently had a call for comments for an updated waiver. You know, I really encourage people, this is when they make those calls to make the comments, but it can't just be a yeah, or no. You've got to put some thought into it. And this is where working with your local ARC or other advocacy agency, a lot of times they'll give you bullets that you can just add and you can use. But I really encourage people to get their voices heard. I mean, it's the only way to make something change.
That's so true. So very true. And, you know, I think that that's a plug for parents and family members and people with disabilities to really like look around and connect with organizations in their communities that are active with respect to public policy. Because, you know, like I used to head up a state agency in Connecticut, and I can say myself that when I was in that position, I was very interested and welcomed the feedback and input from family members. I can't guarantee that every state agency is like that all the time, you know, but that's the dream. That's what is supposed to happen. And I think sometimes you can get a little bit, I don't know, cynical about, oh, it doesn't matter what I say, whatever, but it does. It really does. And sometimes parents have opportunities to testify, and it's really important to get involved and have your voice heard. You know, and like you said, you can get talking points from other organizations as well, which is very helpful.
Yeah, and we're recording this in November, November 11th. So the midterm elections have happened. And maybe that's why it's so front of mind about being so vocal to me. But, you know, that's the other thing. If you're not happy with what's going on in your state, you have the ability to vote and change elected officials.
Right.
You know, and again, that's another point too, where you can get involved with your local chamber or some of these other bigger organizations that have more pull. And if they hear from enough of you that disability concerns are a big deal, they're going to listen, and then they'll bring that to the politicians. And that's how change happens. It doesn't happen overnight, but that's how it happens.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's all kinds of organizations now, and you know, it's impossible to single one particular organization out, but in different venues, you know, we're in the legal space and civil rights, but there's other civil rights organizations that we work with, of course. And there's family organizations and self-advocate organizations and financial planning organizations and all kinds. You know, it's really just take a look around. You don't have to be on your own either, you know.
Exactly. And so I want to circle back about the Social Security. If I'm did my research correctly, there's two federally funded programs that you guys are responsible for: the protection of and advocacy for individuals with developmental disabilities. That can tie into Social Security because a lot of people with developmental disabilities will qualify for SSI, right?
Right.
And then you have the strengthening protections for Social Security beneficiaries for REP-AE, which is obviously more, and then protection advocacies for beneficiaries of Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
So when would somebody be reaching out to a disability rights organization with regards to Social Security? I mean, it's not going to be because they got denied for SSI.
Oh, they do for that. We don't do a lot of that. For the funding that we get from the feds, they're not overly encouraging of us devoting it to that kind of work, because they're, and I say that respectfully, because there are other avenues for people to get assistance with that. And that brings up, like, you know, a significant point about the PNAs, protection and advocacy agencies. One of the goals is that we fill in spaces that other people don't. And it's something that I have to keep in mind in terms of directing our agency, is that, you know, when things come to us, whether they come to us under various grants with respect to the three you just mentioned, or all nine of our federal grants, we really, one of the biggest factors we examine is whether or not there is someone else in the community that can assist that person. And if there is, we try to keep our resources for other issues. But the rep payee, representative payees, are people that, you know, are responsible for handling payments for a person with a disability and helping them with their, you know, management of benefits that they're getting on a monthly basis, whether it's SSI or some other benefit. And so that's one of our most recent grants. It is our most recent grant in terms of our main grants. It started in 2018. And under that grant, the PNAs get a certain number of names from SSA of representative payees to just go and take a look at, make sure that they're doing everything they're supposed to do.
Wow.
That's what that's about. Now, in so doing, we might uncover the fact that somebody doesn't want to have a representative payee, or their representative payee is not doing what they'd like them to do, or their money's being spent on things that they're just not too happy about or even aware of. Or hopefully we discover that everything's great and nothing is wrong and we can check off that box and be okay with that. But that's what that grant is. And it focuses on, you know, there have been terrible abuses of people's Social Security, their SSI and other forms of Social Security benefits. So that's what that is. It's a good fit with the PNAs, but there's other people who, you know, look at representative payees as well. The PAD grant that you mentioned, that's one of our larger grants, protection and advocacy for people with developmental disabilities. We do really focus on, we try to focus on issues very specific to having a developmental disability. Eligibility for state services, for example, is one. Funding and eligibility for, you know, funding from your state agency. We're doing some work on that in Rhode Island. And, you know, it's also an example of how we might get an individual legal case and see that there is an opportunity to take that to a more systemic remedy. Like we might have a series of people, for example, that are coming to us who've been denied eligibility with their state DD agency. You know, like in Maryland, it's called Developmental Disabilities Administration, right? Every state has a different name. In Rhode Island, it's called BHDDH, Behavioral Health, Developmental Disabilities and Hospitals. Every state organizes it differently. But eligibility, you know, as any parent knows, is a tough a tough journey getting your child. Some of us, some people have an easier time than others, but there's a lot of hoops to jump through and you're not always successful. A lot of people come to us when they've been denied eligibility. If we find that helping that family and taking a look at what they've submitted to the state and showing the state where they might've made a mistake in this particular individual's eligibility, if we find that we're successful after a few times, we're going to say to ourselves, and we have, what's wrong with this that these people are getting denied? And maybe there's a systemic remedy that's needed here instead of us taking all these individual cases. You know, is it something that's happening at the agency? Is it an approach that they're using in terms of measuring what people need on a daily basis? There's a lot of factors that go into making those decisions. So that's just one example.
I think it's a great example, Morna, because so several states use IQ as a determinant for whether or not somebody can get benefits. And it bothers the heck out of me because an IQ of 70 is arbitrary. There, right. You know, I haven't seen anything that the IQ correlates to capabilities.
Right.
So I think somebody who has an IQ of 71 not qualifying and somebody with an IQ of 68 qualifying bothers the heck out of me. But that's something... You know, and I don't think Rhode Island's one of the states. I know Connecticut is, but I don't think Rhode Island is. But that could be something, maybe, hopefully, that parents could go to and petition their local disability rights to try to change, or no?
Well, it's pretty tough. I will say this. It's pretty tough to change eligibility requirements with a state agency. It's not that you can't. And people talk about it on a yearly basis during when they're lobbying state legislatures. Lots of parents are saying exactly what you say, that IQ is some kind of arbitrary measure. It really isn't an indication of either deficits or abilities necessarily, that it's really about what we call, as I know you're aware, ADLs, activities of daily living. How are people doing? Like, you know, as you know, the different scales that are used, or we assign numbers to, you know, from 1 to 5, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, you know, how are you at taking care of yourself in your own apartment, cooking, cleaning, dressing yourself, bathing? Like some of those things are very important, but we've got people assigning numbers to those and then adding up the numbers and then deciding if that person meets an arbitrary total number. You know, when you take a step back and you understand, like having run a state agency, I understand like you're filtering out, you can't take everyone. It's a way to filter things out. It's a way to create a waiting list of people that it's a way to define people that are more quote unquote urgent than others. Every state has an emergency list that they keep. And there's different factors that go into that. But really at the end of the day, we're just talking about people who have needs and they need some help on a daily basis, right? And it may or may not have something to do with how their intelligence measures on an IQ test that, by the way, are being increasingly questioned across the board as being a valid test of anything, right? Anything. Yep. Like I talk about that from personal experience because, you know, my son's IQ scores have been all over the board, and I just really don't even pay attention to it any longer, because like anyone with a disability, like any one of us might be functioning at a cognitive level really great one day and not so hot the next day. Yeah. And, you know, we have strengths and deficits, but how do you translate that into policy? How do you translate that into a policy that you can put on paper? That's a struggle. That's a real struggle, because that's what state agencies need. They have to put something on paper. They have to hand it to people and say, this is how you qualify and this is how you don't qualify.
Right. And we've seen with Social Security, who does have very clear outlines of how to qualify and not to qualify, even then, how hard it can be for somebody to get supports, because it still comes down to whoever's behind the desk and what kind of day they're having when you show up.
And does the person who's doing the application have legal assistance in making that application? And can be a very key factor, not even legal assistance, financial planning assistance. I mean, you're a genius at this stuff. So you know exactly what you're doing. I'm not putting a plug in for you, but I know you're very good at that. And like a lot of people just, it's so mind-boggling to think about the world of benefits. It's so exhausting and tiring for people and complicated. So having that assistance is so important, but not everybody gets it. Not everybody can.
Right.
You know, right. It's like speaking a foreign language, you know, it's like having a translator along when you're visiting Germany, you know.
You're right.
It might not be the best example, but.
I want to ask about another one of your programs. What is the Client Assistance Program?
Oh, Client Assistance Program, or CAP, that we refer to, is really helping people. It's employment-based, young people coming out of high school, helping them with transition services, helping them to plan their next steps, whether it be vocational, education-related, job, and helping them connect with their state voc rehab agencies, working with our state voc rehab agency to make sure that we're reaching people that require transition services, and just making sure that, you know, we're doing the outreach that we need to do. And everybody knows what they need to know to make those next steps, because that is such a key time for young people. I mean, some people don't necessarily know that they're entitled to stay in high school for an extended period of time.
Right.
You know, hopefully they found that out from their public school system, but not everybody knows that.
Right. That or find out that they're eligible for voc rehab as early as age 14.
Right. And that they can have somebody from voc rehab come to their transition meetings and their IEP meetings, et cetera. You know, there's a lot of assistance out there. And I love our CAP grant because it helps us, you know, help people in the community make those connections and really find the services that they're entitled to as they move on from the school, the structure of the school systems, not just for people in transition, but it is a large population of those. And, you know, have good planning services and have the assistance that they need to make that transition as smooth as it can be. You know, like, you don't hear a lot, I haven't heard a lot about it recently, but every now and then you get an article about the cliff, you know, like the cliff that people fall off of when they graduate from high school. All of a sudden, there's nothing left for them. You know, you talk about the kids that are living in their parents' basements, you know, with not a lot to do and they don't have jobs. You know, we're trying to make sure that people don't fall off that cliff.
Right. And some of that, like it or not, I feel is going to fall on parents. You know, the transitions, the school transition coordinators are doing the best job they can, but I don't know how many schools they have, depending where, you know, what district they're in. They could have multiple schools. It's not as simple as saying one coordinator has five students. I mean, it's so much more than that. And then with voc rehab, you know, I frequently hear from parents that the voc rehab counselors aren't responsive or they're just not helpful. But if you go there, and this is my bias, if you go there saying, okay, help me, and that's all you give them, it's really not fair. You know, you've got to give them something to work with. What does your, you know, help them find out what your child likes and things like that. But where do you get involved with voc rehab? What would a family be reaching out to you for? I mean, again, because we're looking at more that systemic.
Right at that place that you're talking about. I mean, that's one of them anyway. And I do encourage parents who may be listening to this, if you're having trouble with your voc rehab agency, and they're as different as as can be, and from state to state, you have specific rights if your child qualifies for services with your voc rehab agency, and your state PNA can help you with those rights if they're not being, you know, protected and observed, and your child is not getting the services that they're entitled to. So that is an excellent use of our funding, of one of our 9 federal grants. And we love that. We love that. Well, we love all our grants, but it's a very satisfying grant. You know, you kind of, it's one of those grants where you see the results a little more quickly sometimes than you do in other issues.
Right. Absolutely. No, this has been awesome, Morna. I mean, there's so much I want to touch on because you guys do so much.
We do.
You know, it's, you know, we had touched on, you know, you said you do legal, and really what I see is your focus areas are broken into two different areas, right? You have, like, you keep saying systemic, that's mm-hmm. one area. And then right. we've touched on a couple cases where you go legal. So that's the other area.
Yeah. And they both can be grounded in legal actions, right? But there's multiple avenues. Like we advocated for a change in our law in 2019 to have a supported decision-making law passed in Rhode Island as one example. And I forget how many states, I should know this off the top of my head, but I can't remember how many states have supported decision-making laws at this point. I want to say it's, you know, upwards of 30, maybe more, but supported decision-making is one of our systemic focus areas. And we really push that because as much as we can, and just for anyone who may be listening to this that aren't familiar with that term, it is an alternative to guardianship. Many states have passed laws that essentially talk about supported decision-making as being something of a preferred option for people with disabilities rather than placing them automatically under guardianship because of whatever might have happened, or as many parents, and I'm not criticizing guardianship, let me just be clear about that, because many parents do utilize guardianship, and we're not judgmental about that. We're simply saying that the vast majority of people should be included in decisions about their own lives. And in many cases, we're operating on assumptions that just aren't necessarily accurate. And even people that have significant disabilities can be a central figure in their own decision-making with the right supports, hence the name supported decision-making. So there, I have a good friend, Jonathan Martinez. We did a series of webinar videos with him. Jonathan could make, you know, boiling an egg sound interesting, but he is a fascinating speaker and a tireless advocate for supported decision-making. He was the attorney who handled the Jenny Hatch case, which is a landmark U.S. Supreme Court case on supported decision-making, where she was able to end her guardianship and have a supported decision-making agreement. And, you know, one of the things that I borrow from Jonathan is the very real, what's the word, like the reality that we all use supported decision-making. You know, like I'll get off of this call and call my sister about something that I'm trying to make a decision about in my personal life and get her opinion. Then I'll call another friend of mine and, you know, someone else. And that is what we call supported decision-making. And rather than be taking people's legal rights away, you know, I mean, the midterms just happened, like their right to vote and other rights about their own treatment, about where they live, about what they do in their own daily lives. We should not be doing that when we don't have to. That should not be the default mechanism. So we really prioritize that at our PNA. The PNA network as a whole prioritizes supported decision-making. We're doing a lot to educate communities. Right now, we're getting ready to have a presentation to our Bar Association and hopefully our probate judges on the importance of, you know, having that alternative and making sure that people are aware there is that alternative. We're lucky that we have a law in Rhode Island now, but it's still, you know, there's still some mystique out there. There's still a lot of mystery around how do I do it? You know, what do I need to do? And is my child going to be at risk if I don't have them under guardianship? You know, like it's really just educating people about what it really means. And it is like the next step. One of the most significant next steps, I believe, in creating what we all want, which is authentic inclusion for people with disabilities.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, full disclosure, I'm my son's legal guardian. I think the other thing that in addition to the probate judges, you need to, you know, schools really need to be involved. Because I think there's this almost pipeline from school to guardianship, you know, and some of that is feeding off parents' fears that my child can't take care of themselves or my child can't make a decision. And, you know, I would argue, and again, I own the fact that I'm my son's guardian, but I let him make most of his decisions.
Right.
You know, and I started as early as I could. I mean, you know, I really became his dad when my wife died. You know, before that, the roles were very different. I didn't get involved because I wasn't home. But since she just died, I've always been like, what do you want to do? You've got to make a decision. What do you want? You know, and then there's the dignity of failure. You know, you don't always make great decisions. I haven't always made great decisions. And sometimes there's just natural consequences and, you know, life sucks, you know, and so I say that, and I hope it doesn't sound flippant, because I've put my son in positions where it wasn't that great, and you know, he didn't have the ideal outcome, but that was a choice he wanted.
No, it doesn't sound flippant. It sounds actually very respectful and real, you know, because I mean, your son is living a life just like anyone else. You know, I mean, there's a spirit of, you know, what I would call supportive decision-making and what you're describing, right? And again, I don't judge guardianship. I struggled with it myself as a parent and know many parents who that's their preference, you know? So it's really just, you know, if a person doesn't want it, you know, like, let's say that you didn't have the wonderful relationship that you have with your son and he was like, I don't want this guardianship. Well, that's something to pay attention
right.
to.
Right.
Or if someone's like being forced to do things they don't want to do, or people, you know, programs, some less than reputable and even some reputable residential programs encourage guardianships. That's not a good thing.
Yep.
But what you're talking about in terms of the school and that whole route to guardianship once kids graduate, like that was the case when my son was in high school. You know, we resisted it at the time. But I could tell you that his father and I were in different places with that. And, you know, but yeah, we do reach out to the schools in terms of talking about it as an option. You know, we talk about the many options that there are, you know, like I hold legal power of attorney for my son as well.
Yeah.
So it's a continuum. You know, you're always balancing those fears with helping them be as independent as they want to be and can be. And there's always risk in that, always.
Yeah. I mean, I think about when people say, well, they don't know how to manage their money. I'm like, okay, well, how's your 20-year-old son or daughter in college doing with that money for you? How's that working out for you?
Yeah.
You know,
I want to clarify something I just said. When I say they, I'm talking about my son. I'm speaking as a parent in that regard. I'm not speaking as an advocate for people with disabilities, but yeah, I mean, again, you're just raising the point that it's a continuum of responsibility, making mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes in life. You learn from your mistakes. You learn from your failures. Yeah.
I mean, I would argue you can learn more from your failure than you can from your success.
I think that's true, because you don't want to make that same mistake when you fail. You don't want to live those consequences again. I can think of lots of things that I would do over.
Yeah.
No, right? Absolutely. We all can.
No, this has been awesome, Marna. And thank you for just having a real conversation. You know, I really appreciate it. I think I've enjoyed this. I just enjoy guests like you that are willing to be real and just, you know, this is how it is.
Well, it's great to have someone like you on the other side of this, because, you know, you encourage a conversation. And I think we need more of that. You know, because there's no neat pat answers to any of this stuff. We're all just in the struggle every day and it's really messy, you know, and it's also isolating at times. And I think people forget that, you know, and the more conversations that you can have with people and, you know, podcasts and things like that, that people can tune into, maybe the less alone that somebody will feel, you know, like I'm sure you have your moments of feeling alone, despite the fact that you're plugged into a lot of different things. I have my moments of feeling alone, you know? So it's really just creating those connections as corny as that can sound. It really is about like staying connected to each other. I think people with disabilities, this is going to, I hesitate to say this. I have to say this carefully, because I do not mean it to sound patronizing in the least, and it could sound patronizing. But for me, in my life, I have learned more from my son than probably almost any other person in my life. You know, I've learned about courage. I've learned about what it means to be vulnerable, what it means to be honest, what it means to be real. You know, I mean, it doesn't get more real than these struggles. And also, you know, a lot of us, and not to go off on a whole nother tangent because I know we're wrapping this up, but a lot of us, you know, are lucky enough to have relationships with people with disabilities that don't necessarily haven't acquired all the filters that the rest of us neurotypical people have acquired, or like appropriateness about our behavior. And sometimes they're just out there being real and who they are. And to me, that is the ultimate example of being human. I think more of us should be like that. I think we'd all be a lot happier and the world would be a better place.
And thank you for not saying inspiring. You know, I agree with you, you know, and I think my personal experience has been just since doing this podcast and meeting some people I've met and the graciousness that they've had to let me fumble my way with my questions, you know, about when I'm interviewing somebody who's blind and just, you know, tripping over myself because I'm worried about offending him and but, you know, but sure. he's able, you know, and then we talk it through and just, you know, right. You know, and I own, you know, there've been quite a few of the interviews I've done where whether listeners can pick up on it or not, I've been very uncomfortable because I'm just like, am I saying it right? What should I be saying? You know,
sure.
And I think what I would like to challenge people to do is instead of avoiding people with disabilities because you're uncomfortable, you know, explore why you're uncomfortable and maybe have that conversation. Now they're human, right? They're human beings. There are going to be people you don't like, just like there's going to be people you like. It's not like everybody that has a disability is going to be amazing and this perfect person. They're people. They're people right. First. And as long as you go into it with that expectation, you know, and if somebody's a jerk, somebody's a jerk. You know, they're people. But, you know, I want to get away from this. Oh my gosh, you're so inspiring because you have a disability and you put clothes on today, or you know what I mean? It's going to air before this one airs. I got to interview a Paralympian. Now she was inspiring. That was incredible. Cause not only was she a 3-time Paralympian, she's also started a business and that is insane. You know, I mean, that is a lot. I've started a business and it's a lot. So when I hear inspiring, that's what I think of as inspiring. Inspiring is something that's going to make me want to change what I'm doing. You know, letting somebody with Down syndrome score the last touchdown or something by letting them run down the field on a pose, that's not freaking inspiring. You know, and that's a different rant. And then now I'm getting off on a tangent. So I apologize.
No, not at all. This is all part of the same big conversation. People with disabilities are just people.
Yeah.
You know, and like maybe we, yeah, I'll stop there.
Well, yeah, because it goes back to how I started where I don't like disclosing that I don't consider myself disabled. You know, and it's a lot of stuff that I still have to get over and you know, the community at large has to get over.
Well, that's a whole nother thing too, right? Because more and more people are disclosing their disabilities, like, you know, what we call invisible disabilities, can't see it, you know, but it's there and people live with all kinds of, in particular, emotional and psychological. I mean, I don't even know if we call them disabilities, but that's again, another language discussion, but people have stuff that they're dealing with, you know?
I mean, most of us had some kind of trauma that we were working exactly. through and
right. Right. And we're living with it and we get triggered by things and we don't always act the way we want to, you know, and is that a disability? Ugh, maybe, but it's not always safe to talk about it. Right.
Right. Right.
But I think it's happening more and more. And I will say this in our network, I'm really proud of our network in that the leadership in our network and executive directors and other staff, I don't know if this is a trend, but I'm just experiencing in my conversations with people that people are being more and more open about their own struggles and it demystifies it, destigmatizes it. You know, we talk about destigmatizing mental health troubles. I mean, that's just not that's not really happening. You know, there's all kinds of stigma. Same thing with disabilities. Yep. We have a long way to go. And then I'm back to the very first thing I said, which is maybe we just need to show them like what it looks like when you're, you know, how great it is when you're doing it the way it should be done.
Right.
You know,
I think that's a great way to end it. How can people get in touch with Disability Rights Rhode Island? What's the best way to reach out? Where can they find you and your resources?
Well, our website is www.drri.org. And I should also mention the National Disability Rights Network, which is in Washington, D.C. That is our parent association, so to speak, advocates for us at the federal level. And, you know, we have meetings and such with, you know, various staff and folks in the many PNAs around the country. NDRN, National Disability Rights Network, organizes that. So that's a great resource too. But in Rhode Island, yeah, we've got a website. We've got a phone number, 401-831-3150. You can email us. We've got referral forms on our website. We didn't even talk about, maybe this will be another conversation sometime, but we didn't even talk about our investigations unit, which does a lot of our work and investigates abuse and neglect in the community. We've got a confidential form for reporting abuse or neglect. And or neglect, I should say. So yeah, there's all kinds of ways to get in touch with us. Whatever state you live in, check out your state PNA, Disability Rights Maryland, Disability Rights Virginia. Is not called Disability Rights Virginia. Oh gosh. Colleen Miller is the executive director there. Don't get mad at me, Colleen. I'm forgetting the name. Might be Disability Law Center of Virginia. I can't remember.
I think Maryland changed their name too to Disability Law Center.
Did it? I don't know. I don't know. But basically we're the same entity, but we individually set our focus areas and priorities because we're not a legal aid. I should also say that we're not like we can't take everybody who comes to us, unfortunately, because our funding is super limited.
So. And nothing during this was meant as legal advice or the,
thank you.
Or the opinion of Disability Rights Rhode Island. It's all Morna's opinions only. And
my attorneys will thank you for saying that. They remind me to say that, and sometimes I forget. Thank you, Eric.
You're welcome. This has been awesome.
Great to talk with you.
Prior to recording this interview, I wasn't very familiar with what disability rights organizations did. I really thought they were just a legal organization that people went to when they couldn't find an attorney. I know, overly simplistic, and I apologize to all those disability rights organizations that are out there. It's really incredible, all of the things that Disability Rights Rhode Island does. Morna and I weren't able to touch on everything. They have 12 focus areas, you know, broken into 7 of which are systemic, 5 are legal case representation. They also have 7 factors that you can find on their website to determine whether or not to accept a case. And they have 9 federally funded programs. We touched on some of them, but we didn't touch on all of them. All of this is available on their website. I'm going to include a link in the show notes. And again, I know we talked a lot about Rhode Island. I want you to look at your state. Every state has one. It may not be called disability rights. It might be called something else, but every state has one. I encourage you to look at it, especially if you think you are being discriminated against, or your child is, or someone you care for is being discriminated against. Until next time, thank you for listening.